Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Media Answers Network, and is sponsored by the law offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today are Dr. Philip Gomez, Chief Executive Officer, and Dr. Dennis Ruby, Chief Scientific Officer at Sego Technologies. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
So what I always like to do with my guests before getting into the main part of the conversation is let them provide a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So Dr. Gomez, I'll let you go first.
Thanks. Well, thanks again for having me here today. It's a pleasure. So I was trained as a chemical engineer and have spent most of my career working in infectious disease and designing manufacturing systems, doing translational work in vaccines, anti-infectives, and antivirals. And I've been CEO of SIGA, which is an antiviral company, for the last 4 years. So thanks again.
And Dr. Ruby, how about yourself?
I'm a career virologist. I've actually been working in viruses for more than 45 years, both in academia and in the private sector. I've worked on vaccines, I've worked on antivirals, I've worked in diagnostics, always with an interest of turning basic science into products and useful therapeutics.
Both of you mentioned the antivirals and the vaccines. That would seem to be an extremely hot topic at the moment, given what's happening in the world with COVID-19.
Yes, we're all very optimistic and hopeful.
As you just said, with the optimism around a vaccine, would you be able to kind of give a little bit of a background in terms of kind of what typically goes into the vaccine development process? Because I suspect that when you're reading general news articles out there, it glosses over what are actually the key details in that process.
Well, I'll go first. I mean, basically, a vaccine is two things. One is a delivery system, how you're going to get the immune system to respond. And the other is one or more proteins, which we call antigens, from the pathogen. And as you see in the news now, there's lots of different variety of these going on. Now, where the challenge is picking the right antigen. There are some vaccines like polio, which are very good vaccines, give very durable immunity, and it's quite clear which antigen you need. Others, like influenza, we know the antigens, but they mutate and change every year, so we have to keep making new vaccines. And then for some of these unknown pathogens, and this coronavirus is a good example, we're not yet quite sure what the right antigen or combination of antigens are. And so that'll be the part that we have yet to find out.
That's great. And I would add, so part of my work in translating vaccines into actual products that go into people, I was at the Vaccine Research Center at NIH when SARS happened. And so if you think about what happened during the SARS response, we had to design the antigen that Dennis alluded to. We had to put it in a system that was safe, and we had to prove that it was safe. And it turned out in that instance, we had used a technology used before. Then we had to manufacture it in a way that's highly regulated by FDA to make sure it's safe for people, put it in people, get an immune response, and then get the first data. And I think the encouraging thing I'd like to point out is for SARS, that was a 20-month process. And it was the world record at the time that we did it that fast. For COVID-19, we did it in 3 months. So there has been a lot of progress in the science and the ability to rapidly develop vaccines, not as fast as we all want. But I would say we have improved over the last 20 years.
And kind of what's been able to fuel that type of development?
So I think it's important to say that in vaccine development, what we've figured out is you can't take shortcuts, but you can do a lot of things in parallel. We're hearing that a lot from leaders right now around COVID vaccine development, that if you're prepared to do animal safety testing, if you're prepared to do manufacturing, if you're prepared to do your regulatory filing, which is very complex, if you can do that in parallel, you can shave a lot of time. It's not that you're skipping steps, but you're doing it in parallel. And there are certain technologies that are much faster than others. So even in COVID, we've heard things called nucleic acid vaccines, much faster than something that requires a recombinant protein. So technologies also help.
I think you're just kind of referencing that depending on which vehicle or avenue that you choose to take, that can have an impact on the development timeline. Does one vehicle over another have a different efficacy level as well, or is it that kind of just dependent on the particular vaccine you're working on?
I'll let the virologist answer, I think, Dennis.
Well, There are differences. I mean, in the current situation, a number of the technologies that are being advanced have not yet been proven in the human. There are no approved products using these backbones, so that's a bit of an unknown. As far as the more traditional vaccines, they usually fall in several varieties. One is an attenuated vaccine, which is the live agent that has been made so it can't cause disease. That typically is a very good vaccine because it replicates in the patient and gives a very good antigenic stimulation, so you get long-term immunity, usually with a single shot. That's as opposed to either a killed vaccine or a subunit vaccine, which the protein doesn't actually replicate. You only get one bolus of it, if you will. That usually requires more than one injection, and it usually requires repeat injections a number of years.
Kind of understanding that difference, and then also I think tying into what both of you talked about what has been an increased or shortened cycle in terms of being able to develop, kind of in the, I guess, normal course, if that's even an appropriate statement or, kind of way to phrase it, what's the success rate of when a vaccine's being developed, of, how many of them are actually proven out to work? Because, if I'm thinking about, probably the general pharmaceutical industry, it's, that success rate, usually seems to be relatively low, that a lot of things get experimented on, but then don't actually get proven out to provide the anticipated benefit.
So I don't know the actual number. I'll give that, to Phil. But what I can tell you is I review a lot of grants for NIH and other agencies. I see an awful lot of candidate antivirals and an awful lot of candidate vaccines that never progress. So you're right about that.
Yeah, so as in the industry, I would say vaccines historically have had a slightly higher success rate in that if you can get good results in often animal models and you can get an immune response in a human, it's a little easier to predict whether it's going to be efficacious because you have often a very good biomarker equivalent. I think, though, a really important point as we think about vaccines and COVID is there's also business reasons vaccines fail. So that SARS vaccine I talked about, that was a coronavirus vaccine. We developed it very rapidly at NIH. We did a phase one, an early clinical study, and that sat on a shelf for 20 years. That might have actually, if that had been developed and licensed, might have actually been quite helpful in the current COVID pandemic because it's a coronavirus, might have had some cross protection, but there was no market. Nobody wanted to get a SARS vaccine once it went away. And so we do struggle, I think, with not only technical failures in vaccines, but there are business failures, which may someday come back to be important. Oftentimes, they're not important. So it's a lot harder to do those barriers.
And I'd like to pick up on one thing that Phil said, and that is the use of animals in this process. Typically, you use animals in the development of a vaccine two ways. One is to show that the vaccine is safe and it gives a good immune response. And the other is to show that it actually works and is efficacious. That requires a good animal model. And the animal models we have currently for COVID-19 are not terribly representative of the human disease. And so that's part of the unknown about if these candidate vaccines are going to be effective in the human.
Yeah, and actually, I think I'd like to kind of dive into the points that you're both making. And Dr. Ruby, I think I'll follow up on the point that you were just making about the animal models not necessarily being that accurate. I think that ties back to a point that Dr. Gomez raised a little bit ago, which was, that for the vaccine approval process, and you still want to be able to have the data to back it up. So even though there seems to be relatively rapid progress being made, could that lack of known model end up being a slowing down point? Although it seems like it's also progressed into human model or human trials without that data as well.
Yeah, I think certainly there's a little bit of more unknown, but we certainly are doing the safety part of the animal studies before anything goes into humans. So that part is not being skipped, if you will. We're doing the best we can with available animal models, but the real proof is going to require going into the human and or humans that ultimately get challenged with the virus in the community. So I think we are progressing appropriately, but it's not in the traditional manner.
Yeah, no, and I think that piece is also really important because it feels like there's still so much discourse in the in the public about concerns about safety around vaccines, and it sounds like this is an accurate statement that it's while we're still trying to figure out how to what the appropriate vehicle for this vaccine is as a baseline. it should be absolutely clear that vaccines are completely safe and that there is tremendous benefit that derives from them.
Yes, I'd certainly agree with that. And to go back to even the animal model point, typically in vaccine development, you would wait until all that animal data showed efficacy purely because you didn't want to risk the cost of a human study until you had evidence of that it was going to work. And with COVID, we appropriately have said, let's go in parallel. So people are still working on animal models for efficacy, I'm sure, and maybe we'll get some informed decisions along the way. But really, the gold standard for efficacy and whether it works will be the placebo-controlled studies in humans. And that's really the data that we're going to get to show that, in fact, the vaccine works. But all of the things around safety of manufacturer, safety of delivery, the platform, there's an awful lot of data out there that's being gathered, and historical data. So a lot of these platforms have been used routinely in the past, so we can leverage a lot of historical data as well.
No, I think that's great. And it's, you know, I think it's unfortunately a point that probably needs to be repeated more often. But, a minute ago, I said that there was a point that both of you brought up that I wanted to dive into. So now we'll turn to the point that you raised, Dr. Gomez, about the business model and the business limitations that can factor into, how vaccines are utilized and further developed. And you were mentioning the SARS vaccine that you'd had the opportunity to work on and the fact that it got shelved because SARS kind of went away and you didn't have to worry about it. Knowing that it's probably difficult to predict, but do you have a sense of where things could end up going with a COVID vaccine, especially given the point that I think Dr. Ruby you were making earlier about the fact that, you know, there are some vaccines that are constantly being tinkered with because you're seeing the virus that it's meant to target mutating and evolving over time?
Yeah, I'll have a couple of comments on it, and I'm sure Dennis has thoughts on that as well. So it is interesting to watch in some ways the investor high swings high and low, because I think they're trying to interpret, is this going to be a one-time vaccine and it goes away and we never need it, which is certainly a possibility. Is this going to be something that keeps coming back because, to Dennis's point, the modality we're using isn't giving durable protection, so we're going to need booster shots, every year? That's a very different business model than one and done. So I do think we are going to have to let the science follow, but it's going to be driven by what's the need to protect the virus.
Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns here. And certainly, in addition to the traditional business model, we'll have to factor in governmental support. The government certainly tries to keep a list of what they think the most likely pandemic agents might be and to stockpile countermeasures that are available to fight them. So I suspect with how coronavirus has played out, there will be an effort to keep vaccines and antivirals in the stockpile for future events.
Yeah, and actually that kind of raises a question that I'll toss out there, and I'm not sure if either of you are able to provide insight into it, but kind of these upfront orders that the government has placed with, I think, at least two of the companies that are doing the COVID vaccine development, is that standard or is that kind of a unique circumstance given what's happening right now?
So I can talk to the business of it, and then Dennis could talk to maybe what it's like to develop these products. So at SIGA Technologies, we make an antiviral drug for smallpox. And smallpox is something that we worry could be released or out in the environment. And so the U.S. government stockpiles vaccines and our antiviral drug. There is a group within Health and Human Services called the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority that anticipates what could cause an outbreak. And they try and work with companies like us to develop and stockpile those drugs. So we developed that product, and Dennis can talk about the details of it, but they placed an order before we even finished our FDA approval, that standard effort. And what it does is it incentivizes companies like us to work on this, because without the government, we have no market. Nobody is privately thinking about smallpox. It's really the government that has to do it on all our behalfs and make sure that there's adequate product in a stockpile.
Yeah, but I would say to your point, Matthew, this is a little different in the sense that both stockpiling our drug and similar drugs was usually done at a point in which there was pretty clear scientific evidence that the drug or vaccine was going to work. And there's just a matter of what type of regulatory steps had to be followed. In the current situation, I think the government, rightly so, is taking a bit of a gamble. They're gambling, one, that these vaccines that they're funded are going to work. And they're gambling, two, that we're going to actually need as many doses as they're procuring. But given the seriousness of the disease, I think it's a perfectly reasonable approach.
Yeah, no, it seems it's kind of in one of those circumstances of, you know, the situation is going to drive the response, which I think kind of seems to be a kind of an overall theme when it comes to COVID. But for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Drs. Gomez and Ruby from SIGA Technologies, and we've been talking about vaccine development. And what I'd actually like to do a little bit of a pivot right now, and this kind of, I think, ties into what you were just mentioning, Dr. Gomez, about what the two of you at your company have worked on. And, you know, the concept of health security that I think you focus on. So kind of before we explore that, would one of you be able to give, you know, maybe a bit of a definition and explanation in terms of what you mean by security? Because I think what listeners of this show might typically expect would be cybersecurity of our information technology systems. But I know that's not what you're focused on.
Yeah, so I'll do briefly and then we can expand on it. So very simply, health security are products you hope you never use, but you're really glad you have. And so we make, as I mentioned, a antiviral drug for smallpox. We all hope smallpox never gets released and that we have a smallpox outbreak, but we will be very glad if we do. And for those low probability but very high consequence events, it's very important to have products like ours stockpiled.
I think the only thing I would add is health security is broader than people think about. I mean, certainly in the case of an infection, you're going to want PPE. You need to have a diagnostic available so you can tell who's been infected, what they've been infected with. And in an ideal world, you're going to want to have a drug, an antiviral, probably a monoclonal antibody of some sort to treat people with, and then ultimately a vaccine that will prevent it. And so health security for any individual agent is actually a combination of these things.
So kind of with that description, you know, is it fair to say that, you know, health security is really a component of a public health policy that would be aimed at, you know, maybe thinking about a bunch of different scenarios and being and trying to plan for different scenarios?
I actually think a lot of people think of it as part of national security. So Bill Gates and several of his talks about pandemics has advocated very strongly that public health and especially potential pandemics and outbreaks are at their very root a national security issue that obviously we've seen with COVID. It's had trillions of dollars of economic impact. It's disrupted economies. It's disrupted political structures. And so it's very important for countries to think about it in the context of national security. And most countries' national security infrastructures don't do biology. They don't think about vaccines and drugs, but he and others have advocated that we need to think that broadly, both for naturally occurring and what might be purposely released by terrorists or the like. And so a robust public health infrastructure, to your point, in fact, is critical to national security. So it is very broad.
With that angle to it, of, you know, arguing that it should be, you know, part of national security, you know, do you get the sense that part of the reason for that argument might be that budget is more readily, you know, funded and funded at higher levels for national security as opposed to public health?
That's a great question. I would say those that advocate for and believe that this is a critical issue have pointed out that funding for this type of work has not been adequate. And in fact, we are not as well prepared for these types of outbreaks, and we don't spend as much as you would in other areas. So one of the assistant secretaries at HHS has pointed out we have kind of half an aircraft carrier to deal with this event, where we have multiple aircraft carriers on the defense side. And it's used to illustrate the fact that we have to understand the threats of both sides, prepare for them. But I do think a theme for many years, as we found out in this outbreak, when we heard the Strategic National Stockpile didn't have enough ventilators, didn't have enough PPE, many people were saying that for many years. Unfortunately, we didn't spend the money to build up that stockpile to the levels that would be needed in a pandemic.
Or do you have suggestions in terms of strategies to, you know, get the broader, you know, legislature or regulators or, you know, or really just the appropriate people in charge to pay attention to those warnings and to appropriately plan for, you know, a pandemic like this, or, you know, as you said, it could even be some, you know, a terror attack or, you know, any other type of, you know, scenario that gives rise to the need for a response?
Yeah, so I would say there's been tabletop exercises, educating people on what a, you know, pandemic influenza epidemic would do. But quite frankly, COVID has illustrated all of the points that are made on those tabletops, that the virus would spread rapidly, there would be devastating human health impact, there would be devastating economic impact. And so I am hopeful, unfortunately, one of the things that will come out of this will be we will prepare better for future pandemics and we will make those investments. I think it was Senator Tom Cole who recently said spending billions to save trillions is a no-brainer, meaning we actually do have to invest in preparedness and these drugs and vaccines and diagnostics because the cost of not having them is trillions in economic impact and a lot of lost lives.
So, and then, you know, in terms of that investment and that development, are there particular, you know, areas of the government or areas of, you know, probably private partnership that can, you know, render the most value?
Yeah, I'll defer to Dennis. Dennis describing his partnership with the government over the last 20 years has been amazing.
Well, certainly, I was going to bring this point up, and that's a good lead-in. I think one of the things COVID has illustrated is that there are a lot of government agencies involved in a response like this. One of the things that's been lacking, and I hope we learn from this, is to have plans in place ahead of time, a concept of operations about with the countermeasures you have, how do you deploy them, who gets them, where do they go, and be able to make those kind of decisions in real time without having to have a lot of Zoom calls and teleconferences to figure it out. So I'm hoping that's part of the coordination that will come out of this situation.
So in terms of, you know, thinking about how to coordinate a response and who should be involved, you know, on the whole, should that be the same regardless of the, you know, the pandemic, the particular pandemic or type of attack you might be talking about, or, you know, does there need to be a lot of nuance depending on what the underlying cause is?
I think it's pretty similar because we have some agencies in the U.S. like the CDC that are just responsible for infectious diseases. NIH is a center of excellence for the research and basic knowledge. BARDA, that Phil mentioned earlier, has some of the funding and development programs in place. And they have mechanisms of communication between the agencies in place now. So I think they'll all be involved in any type of infectious agent response.
And in terms of that, you know, are there, I guess, models or other, you know, kind of uniform policies or, you know, other standards that are available now that could help inform, you know, the further implementation or further development. So that way, you know, I think as both of you are suggesting, you know, we're better prepared the next time this happens, because unfortunately it probably is a matter of when, as opposed to, and if something like this could happen again, probably shouldn't even be on the table.
Yeah. So I do think one of the debates that is important is the funding level. There are a lot of plans, and quite honestly, there are some diseases that we have some pretty good vaccines, drugs, and diagnostics that are stockpiled, but we haven't done it broadly enough and we haven't done it deep enough. And that's unfortunately been a funding limitation of people being able to do it. So could we better coordinate? Absolutely. Do we need more technologies? Absolutely. But just implementing on a lot of the plans that have been articulated, you know, to go to the point of BARDA, which is the agency that we talked about that developed drugs, they've had over 50 approvals of new medicines to be able to treat everything from anthrax to plague to Ebola and the like. But the budget to buy those products hasn't increased hardly at all in the last 10 years. We've had a lot of success, but we haven't actually followed through in making sure those products are available when needed and be able to be, you know, in that stockpile.
So, you know, you guys, kind of believe it or not, but we're already starting to get pretty close to the end of our time. So what I'd like to be able to do is wrap up our conversation with two related questions and would certainly like to get thoughts from both of you. So the first one is, you know, with the current pandemic, you know, what do you think is the biggest positive that can be identified and should offer, you know, the glimmer of hope for going forward?
So I'd say we have learned to do this faster. I'd go back to SARS, it was 20 months. For West Nile virus, it was faster. And for COVID, it was 3 months to get in the clinic. This is really through the effort of a lot of scientists, a lot of engineers, a lot of clinicians that have all been thinking about how do we accelerate development of a vaccine for an event just like this.
I would add that I think seeing the outcome of COVID-19 will drive better funding in this area. So better research, better stockpiling. And so I think that's one of the things we will learn is just the very importance of these type of agents.
No, and I think that's very fair, and as both of you said, pretty consistent with the overall discussion. So as I kind of led in with, I do have the two part to it, and the second part is going to be the flip side, which is, you know, what part of the response has disappointed you the most? And Dr. Ruby, I'll let you go first, since Dr. Gomez went first on the first part.
The biggest disappointment I've had is just the apparent lack of leadership in the response, because there's so many agencies involved, all of whom have some vested interest in moving it forward. They haven't been as coordinated as I would have hoped for, and I hope that'll be an outcome we can change in the future.
Yeah, and I would actually echo Dennis's point. I think it is hard to underestimate the leadership challenge this epidemic presents. It has touched every person in our country, every corner. But having a game plan that you can follow is what all of the folks that work in disaster preparedness would tell you, that you can't make up a plan once it happens. You have to be very confident you have one and you're following it to make sure you go forward. And I think we're going to strengthen our plans as we go forward. And I hope that's an area we do improve on greatly.
And I think those are, you know, both great points. And, you know, I think it's, I'm not surprised to see that both of you turned it into the positive of, you know, it offers that opportunity to learn. And, you know, I think kind of the ultimate message is, if something like this is happening, you know, no matter what your viewpoints are on many things, everyone should be banding together and collaborating to address a major disaster like this. But believe it or not, as I said, we are already out of time. So I want to thank my guests, Dr. Philip Gomez and Dr. Dennis Ruby, for a great conversation today.
Thank you, Matt.
Glad to be here. I enjoyed it.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at #HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.